Well, welcome back to our Old Testament survey. Once again, we are going through the books of the Old Testament, looking at a different one each week, and we are going through them in the order that they appear in the Hebrew Bible. And so we're currently in this third grouping of the books known as the Writings, which teach us how to live as God's people. Last week, we looked at the book of Lamentations that dealt with life in exile and the hardships that they encounter there. This evening, we are looking at the book of Esther, But before we dive into Esther, I want to just read a couple of verses from the book of Acts. As Paul was in Athens and speaking there to the philosophers in Athens, he said this to them in Acts chapter 17, verse 24. He says, "The God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their preappointed times and their boundaries of their dwellings, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being." So as we approach the book of Esther tonight, that passage is a good summary of what happens in the book of Esther. God is sovereign over the details of our lives. And even as the people are in exile, Jerusalem has been destroyed, the temple has been destroyed, but God is not absent. He is not far from them, even in their exile. For a little bit of historical context, a brief timeline that will help us kind of put Esther in her proper place. Babylon destroyed Jerusalem in 586 BC. And so Judah was taken captive at that time. In 539 BC, Persia conquered Babylon and became the world power. And 1 year later, in 538, Cyrus, the king of Persia, allowed the Jews who wished to do so to return back to Jerusalem and the land of Judea. In 537 BC, the first group of exiles did return to the land under the leadership of Zerubbabel. And then in 583 BC is about when the story of the book of Esther takes place. It takes place over the course of about 10 years or so here in the book of Esther, as we'll see as we go through it. And then shortly after the book of Esther, there is a second group of exiles that return back to the land under the leadership of Ezra. And that is followed, of course, then by Nehemiah's governorship over Judea. So that kind of gives us the historical context so we know where Esther falls. We can see that from the events of her life that occur after the first Jewish return to Jerusalem, she's part of the group of Jews who decided not to return. Her family did not return. They stayed in Persia, and we'll see that Mordecai had a pretty good job there, and so they apparently decided to stay where they were rather than to return. We also know that Ezra, the priest and scribe who wrote the book of Ezra and most likely wrote 1st and 2nd Chronicles, possibly compiled Nehemiah from Nehemiah's journals, may also be the author of the book of Esther. There's no author mentioned here in the book, but Ezra was a contemporary. He was there when these events took place. He is a scribe, which Mordecai was as well, so it's possible even that Ezra might have known Mordecai or worked with him, and we know that Ezra was an accomplished historian, so it is quite possible that he was the author of this book. The primary original audience for the book of Esther would have been the Jews who continued to live in exile throughout the world, that were scattered throughout the Persian Empire. Esther was the last book that was accepted into the canon of the Hebrew Scriptures. Now, there was some hesitation to consider it part of Scripture for two primary reasons. One, like the Song of Songs, God is never mentioned in the book. There's no mention of Yahweh anywhere in the book of Esther. And then because of that, the book itself reads almost like a secular history in many ways rather than a book of scripture. But we'll see as we go through it that it very much is teaching us about God. The book's obvious purpose, of course, is to introduce to us the observance of a holiday known as Purim. That's one of two festivals that were added to the Jewish calendar outside of the books of Moses, the other one being Hanukkah, which celebrates an event that happened in that intertestamental period between the Old and the New Testament. The secondary purpose the book serves is to demonstrate for us the terrors of living in exile, the lack of power and security that the exiles would have felt, the possibility of annihilation hanging over them constantly, and the hatred that they experienced from other people groups all work together to sort of give us a picture of the constant fear that would attend their lives in exile. Of course, these are things that we are often not familiar with, but have continued down even into the modern age for the Jewish people, as we think about the Holocaust of World War II as another example of some of those same things. The book, primarily for us, serves as a meditation on the sovereignty of God in the details of life. As that passage that I read from Acts 17 said that God is sovereign over where men live, the boundaries of their dwelling. He is sovereign over all the details of our lives. And we'll see that as we go through the book of Esther, that God is very much in the details. Remember that Lamentations left us with God's people in exile, separated from the promised land, from the presence of God in the temple, and in grief and sorrow over the destruction of their nation. And so as the book of Esther opens, some time has passed. We're now about 100 years after that exile began. God's people are still in exile, a different ruler, no temple for them to worship in. So how are God's people to live in these circumstances? How are they to think of their God who created everything when his people are in this position of no power, no control, basically almost living as slaves in exile once again? Is God still sovereign, or is he incapable of working for the good of his people in these circumstances? The book consists of six primary sections. The first three build the tension in the story until it reaches its peak. So we have chapter one, which is the story of Vashti, the queen of Persia, who gets demoted from being queen and exiled away from the king. And then in chapters two and three, we see the story of Esther becoming queen and Haman decreeing to destroy the Jews. And then in chapters 4 and 5, we see Haman's plot to destroy Mordecai specifically. And so the tension is built, the reader is on edge, and then in good Hebrew fashion, we see that, once again, that chiastic pyramid that happens where the final three sections reverse the situations that occurred in the first half of the book that were causing the tension, and they do so in reverse order. Chapters 6 and 7 detail forth Haman's defeat. Chapters 8 and 9 give us the Jews' defense and their victory over their enemies, and then chapter 10 gives us Mordecai's promotion, where chapter 1 had been Vashti's demotion. So, and right in the middle of that, there's a pivot point where everything begins to change. The story turns on a very small and rather insignificant detail. The Jews were more or less helpless before their enemies, and then this one little event happens that changes everything, and all of those plot points begin to be reversed in dramatic fashion. And we'll see what that detail is when we get to it. But Esther, chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. So here is the king. He's also known in history as Xerxes I. He ruled over a vast empire of Persia. History records for us that he loved war and battles and, you know, the honor that came from victory. He loved women and he loved parties. He's mentioned elsewhere in Scripture in the book of Ezra and in Daniel as well. One of the wars that he fought shortly after he became king was a battle against the Greeks known as the Peloponnesian War. The Persian navy was destroyed there in a battle against the Greeks. And historians tell us that Xerxes returned home to his capital to distract himself from this utter defeat. And to do so, he threw a large feast in the capital city in order to kind of distract himself from being upset about his military defeat. And so that's where the book of Esther picks up. If we look at verse 2, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So the king throws this party that lasts for a year and a half, or half a year, and it's a great display of his wealth. And then at the end of this impressive show, he tops it off with a week-long celebration, a feast for the entire capital city. And then in verse 7 it says, and they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. So there's plenty to drink, and each man is free to drink as he wishes. And then in verse 9, we're introduced to the queen, Queen Vashti. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So she's hosting a feast for the women in the palace, separate from the feast the king is hosting. And then we see in verse 10 that with this abundant drink comes some drunkenness. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abgatha, Zethar, and Carcass, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. So the king gets a little drunk and decides not only is he going to show off his wealth and his might, he wants to show off his beautiful wife. And as we know, drunken people don't always make the wisest decisions. We saw that in the book of Proverbs, and so this might not have been the wisest decision for him, because she's not inclined to come put on a beauty pageant for him and all his drunken friends. So when he commands her to come, she says no in verse 12. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. So drunk or not, it's not really a good idea to anger the king, and so he loses his temper. He wants to punish her for her disobedience. But the Persian Empire loved its laws and its rules, and so he consults with his wise men to see what can be done about this situation. They were of the opinion that if she were permitted to get away with this sort of behavior, that other women in the empire would follow her example, lose respect for their husbands, and disobey them. And so his counselors tell him that he needs to make an example of her so that rather than other women trying to imitate her, they would live in fear because of her punishment and not defy their husbands. So his advisors counsel him to draft a legal document exiling the queen and then to replace her with another woman. So chapter 2 begins with this search for a new queen, one who is both beautiful and presumably will be obedient. Chapter 2, verse 1, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. The thing pleased the king, and he did so. So a search is made throughout the vast empire to find a replacement for his deposed queen. Now you'll notice that the primary qualification for the office is physical beauty, not moral character. The king is not necessarily looking for someone to govern with him. He's looking for another beautiful woman to be his prized possession, so to speak. So the wisdom of the world is at work here in the king's actions. But as we'll see, God is superintending the process so that the woman he chooses to be in this position is the woman that God would have to be there. And so we read in verse 5, "In Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured when Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter." So right in the capital city lives this man Mordecai, a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin. Now exile was hard, and many people had lost their lives in the conquest of Jerusalem. Many more, presumably, had lost their lives in the process of being taken into exile and traveling that distance. And apparently, Mordecai's uncle and aunt had died, leaving behind his younger cousin, Hadassah. And so he takes her and raises her as his own daughter. Her Hebrew name is Hadassah. Her Persian name is Esther. And she is a beautiful girl. But she's more than just beautiful. She is also humble and wise, for she listens to counsel and takes advice. We see in verse 10 that Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. So she takes his advice not to reveal the fact that she was a Jew. And then we see in verse 15, "Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go in to the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her." So she took the advice of the eunuch in charge of the women, whose favor that she had won back in verse 8. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor, so he readily gave her beauty preparations to her, besides her allowances. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. So Esther undergoes then a year of beauty preparations. And there's no particular reason given why she should be favored by this eunuch who is in charge, other than the fact that God is working out the details to bring about his will. So as he moves in the circumstances to make these things happen. It's been 4 years now since Vashti had been dethroned, and so the search for a queen continues. And so in verse 16 it says, "So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign." And so once again, she finds favor in the king's sight and is made queen. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. So a poor Jewish girl in exile has become queen of the largest empire on earth. Her cousin Mordecai then takes a central role in the plot throughout the rest of the book. Look at verse 21 with me. "In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, 2 of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on the gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king." So Mordecai just happens to be in the right place at the right time to uncover a plot to kill the king. He relays the information through his cousin, who is now queen, and the conspirators are caught and executed. And a tiny little thing at the end of verse 23 is extremely important. The details of the event were recorded in the official records of the kingdom. It's recorded, but notice that Mordecai is not recognized or rewarded by the king in any way, which is somewhat unusual. And this will prove to be important later in the story. But again, we see God's fingerprints all over these events as they occur. And so as we move into chapter 3, we are introduced to the main villain in our story, Haman. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, an Agite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. Now, how do we know that Haman is a villain from this little introduction? Well, two things. First, after the events at the end of chapter 2, we would expect Mordecai to be promoted or rewarded by the king in some way, and he isn't. Instead, this Haman is promoted to a position roughly equivalent to being the prime minister of the empire. Second, just as Mordecai was introduced with his lineage, so Haman is introduced with his, and it tells us that Haman is an Agagite. Commentators are divided over his actual lineage. Some think that he is descended from King Agag, the king of the Amalekites that we read about in 1 Samuel 15. Others have noted that there was a Persian province that was named Agag, and so it may have just been that he was a prince from that province of Persia. Either way, to any Jewish reader, that name would immediately identify him as an enemy by virtue of being associated with the Amalekites. So an enemy has been promoted rather than Mordecai, and he has been promoted to the highest office in the land next to the king himself. And so it continues in verse 2, "And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, 'Why do you transgress the king's command?' Now it happened, when they spoke to him daily and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai." So Mordecai refuses to bow to Haman, and we have to ask ourselves why. Why would he refuse to bow? And there's no law in the scriptures anywhere that would prohibit honoring and respecting a government official or even bowing to them. It was actually pretty common. But it's made clear that his refusal to bow is somehow tied to his Jewishness. He told them that he was a Jew, and this is why he did not bow. As in many ancient cultures, the king would often be worshipped as some sort of deity. Even his top princes could be considered lesser deities themselves. And so John Gill comments and says, "It was not mere civil honor that was required and given, for that the Jews did not refuse to give, and that in the most humble and prostrate manner, and was admitted by them. Nor can it be thought that Mordecai would refuse to give it from pride and sullenness, and thereby risk the king's displeasure, the loss of his office, and the ruin of his nation. But it was such kind of reverence to a man and worship of him which was contrary to his conscience and the law of his God." So Mordecai didn't simply break the king's commandment because he didn't like it or didn't respect this particular person, but rather he refuses to honor Haman and bow to him as before a god. His refusal is based on his convictions as a worshiper of Yahweh, and not merely the fact that I'm not going to bow to him because I don't respect him. Haman, of course, takes offense to this. He determines that he wants to destroy all of the Jews. If this particular Jew is going to have this way about him, then the rest of them must similarly believe the way he does, worship the way he does. They're going to refuse to bow down to me. I want to destroy them all. Notice the similarities here between Mordecai and Vashti. Both refused a command of the king. They refused to, in some way, honor someone that everyone else was honoring at the time. The results of their actions have personal consequences and national ones. Vashti is exiled, and an empire-wide search to replace her commences. Mordecai is now in Haman's crosshairs, and we'll see that Haman goes to great lengths to, in his desire to kill Mordecai, but now all of Israel is threatened as well, including Esther, the queen. And so Haman begins this plot to destroy God's people in verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is, the lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month, until it fell in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So Esther's been queen for 5 years at this point. Haman and his advisors cast lots to determine the most favorable day and month of the year for an action against the Jews. Now, Haman is seeking a sign. He's casting lots. This is a practice of little stones or sticks of some kind, almost like rolling dice. He's trying to get some sign from the powers that be. When is the best day? When is the day when all the stars are aligned properly for me to take this action to destroy these people? That's ironic because Esther, her Persian name, actually means star. So Haman is seeking what is the best day, the best time, and they would, of course, use the stars and the constellations to determine some of these things. And while he is seeking a sign from the stars, it is a Jewish girl whose name has been named Star in his language that will be his undoing. So Haman takes the next step in his evil plot. Back up for a minute. He goes through this process of casting lots, and notice that it's the first month when he goes to do this, and the lot that's chosen is the 12th month, which gives the Jews a whole year to figure out what and to be delivered from this plot that Haman is hatching against them. Again, God is in the details. Why didn't it select the next day or a week or just a month later and not give them time to respond? It gave them an entire year for this to unfold. So God is in the details of all of this. But he takes the next step in his plot in verse 8. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain." Now, Haman is told a truth here. The Jews are scattered throughout the empire. He's also told a half-truth. They did keep the law of God, which was different from the laws of the Persian religions and the Persian empire, but that doesn't mean that they were bad citizens or couldn't keep most of the king's laws and obey them as long as the king was not giving them a law that would conflict with God's law. And he tells one outright lie, that the Jews' adherence to God's law would make them bad citizens to the point where they needed to be killed. He also lies by omission because he never tells the king who this group of people is. He just tells him there's a group of people out there, they need to be destroyed. He doesn't tell the king who they are. And then he adds a bribe to his lies in verse 9. "If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries." The 10,000 talents is a lot of money. Depending on which measurement of a talent you use, a Babylonian measure or a Jewish measure, it amounts to somewhere between 375 to 1,050 tons of silver. That's a lot of money. Obviously, he came from wealth. Maybe he was the prince of a province there in Persia. He is bribing the king to let him destroy an entire people group. And he seems to be acknowledging in doing so that this is going to cost the empire something. To kill all of these people will affect the empire's revenue. It will affect the economics of the empire. And so he is going to offset that with this massive bribe that will go directly into the king's treasuries. And so the king gives Haman his signet ring and the authority to act on his plot. And then we're told in verse 12, then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all people, to every province according to its script, and to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. So the day that the edict to destroy the Jews was written, it tells us there on the 13th day of the first month, that day, again, in a little twist of irony here on the Lord's providence, that day was the day before Passover. And so while Haman is preparing to destroy the Jews, the faithful in exile who would be keeping the Passover are preparing to celebrate the Passover the next day. They're in exile, someone is plotting their destruction, and they are preparing to celebrate God's deliverance from a previous exile in Egypt. This would not be lost on Jewish readers who would see the hand of God and the timing of these events. And then in verse 13, and the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. And the couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. Now the Persian royal courier system was very highly efficient, and history records for us that it had a motto that was later adopted by our own U.S. Postal Service. Neither rain nor sleet nor dark of night shall keep the appointed messenger from his rounds. And so they take this king's decree published by Haman out to the entire empire. No reason is given why the Jews should be destroyed and killed in this decree. They're to be killed and plundered for no apparent reason. And the king seems unaware of just what has been done in his name. Haman, of course, is delighted with himself, but the rest of the capital city is left in confusion about why such a thing would be done. They're perplexed, the text says. Well, then, beginning in chapter 4, things are looking bad for Israel. Mordecai begins to mourn the situation. He puts on sackcloth and ashes, and he is not alone. In verse 3 it says, and in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fastings, weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So Mordecai and Esther speak through messengers, and Mordecai tells her that she must speak to the king about this. But to go before the king without an invitation is not safe, and so Esther is reluctant. Then Mordecai answers her reluctance in verse 13. And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" While there is no mention of God here, Mordecai is obviously trusting in God's providence to deliver his people. And so Esther asks the people to pray and to fast for 3 days, and they do. And then on the third day, Esther presents herself before the king, and once again we see that God gives her favor. In chapter 5, verse 2, it says, "So it was, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight. The king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter." So she does not suffer Vashti's fate, but is accepted by the king. And he then asks her why she has come before him. What is it that she desires from him? And instead of pleading for her people, she invites the king to a feast and tells him to bring Haman, his right-hand man, with him. And then at dinner, the king asks her again what her petition is. And again, she invites the two of them to another feast the following night, promising that then she will make her request known. So in chapter 5, verse 9, it says, "So Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. So Haman leaves the banquet the first night in a good mood, which is quickly soured when he sees Mordecai. And so he goes home, gathers his friends and his wife, brags about how rich he is, how honored he is by the king, how he is the only one besides the king that the queen had invited to her banquet. And then he says in verse 13, "Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." I mean, his hatred is so irrational. He counts all his blessings of wealth, his family, honor from the king, but says that it's all worthless because this one man has annoyed him. So he takes counsel from his wife and his friends. In verse 14, "Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, 'Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet.' And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made." So chapter 5 ends with even greater danger than had previously been there. The Jews are just months away from being annihilated by their enemies, and now a gallows has been built for the express purpose of executing Mordecai. At this point, the tension in the story is at its highest. The Jews are in a desperate situation, and Mordecai's life is in imminent danger. And just now is when a very small and insignificant thing happens, and it is intended, indeed ordained by God for the salvation of his people. We read in chapter 6, verse 1, "That night the king could not sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king." It's a small thing, a sleepless night, but it happens to be the very night that Mordecai is plotting and building a gallows to hang, that Haman is building a gallows to hang Mordecai on. The king has a sleepless night. We've all had one of those. And in an effort to lull himself to sleep, he has someone come and read to him the official court records. If anything is designed to put you to sleep, it's having the court records read to you. But this sleepless night and choice of reading material is the turning point in the story. It's the pinnacle of that chiastic pyramid as all of Haman's plots begin to unravel from this point forward. The king spends this sleepless night listening to someone read these boring court records to him, but he discovers something. He discovers an oversight. Chapter 6, verse 2, "And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Then the king said, 'What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this thing?' And the king's servants who attended him said, 'Nothing has been done for him.'" So he discovers that he never rewarded Mordecai for saving his life. And so he determines he's going to right this wrong and do so immediately. So he asks, "Which of his officials is nearby? I need someone to carry out my will in this matter." In verse 4, "So the king said, 'Who is in the court?' Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, 'Haman is there standing in the court.' And the king said, 'Let him come in.'" So you can see where the story is going. Haman is coming in to ask permission to hang Mordecai right at the very moment when the king is looking for someone to carry out his will in honoring Mordecai. And so in verse 6, "Haman came in, and the king asked him, 'What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?' Now Haman thought in his heart, 'Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?' So Haman, in his conceit, tells the king to honor this man by putting a royal robe on his shoulders, letting him ride on the royal horse with a crown on his head, and be paraded through the city and announced by one of the king's trusted princes. And now this is pretty bold. The king's robe, the king's crown, the king's horse, and led through the city by a prince. It seems Haman wishes that he were king, because he thought this is what the king was going to do for him. But his pride has turned back on him, and he is forced to humble himself before Mordecai, the one that he hates. And so we read in chapter 6, verse 10, "Then the king said to Haman, 'Hurry, take the robe and the horse as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken.' So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Now Haman is humiliated by this, I'm sure. His hatred for Mordecai had been no secret. So he goes home. He takes counsel with his wife and his friends and realizes that his schemes have begun to come unraveled. The king had just honored Mordecai like no one before had been honored. What if the king asks what this huge gallows in the front yard is for? What if he realizes it's Mordecai and his people that are scheduled for destruction? And then Haman is summoned to the queen's second feast. And at the banquet, Esther makes her request known to the king. In chapter 7, verse 3, then Queen Esther answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." Now the king is worked up. He wants to know who would do such a thing. Verse 5, so King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" And Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Haman's day has just gone from bad to worse in the space of about four sentences. The king is furious. He storms out of the place where they're having the feast into the palace garden. He was fooled by Haman, who never told him which people he was plotting to destroy. He's learned that he didn't really know his wife that well. He didn't know that she was a Jew. He probably feels a little bit foolish. He's probably angry because of this. In the meantime, Haman is pleading for his life, and in doing so, he falls across the couch where Esther is reclining. And when the king returns at just the right moment, again, to find Haman laying across the couch, he thinks that Haman is attempting to attack the queen in his presence. And then one of the king's eunuchs speaks up in verse 9. Now, Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. So chapter 7 has undone the threat of chapter 5, but there's still a death threat looming over the Jewish people. And chapter 8 begins, we see that Haman's authority has now been given to Mordecai. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. This is a good thing, but the threat of Haman's plot is still active. So Esther asked the king to revoke the documents that legalized the threat, but once a Persian law has been signed and stamped with the king's signet that can't be undone, a new law must be written. And so in verse 8, the king tells her, "You yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews as you please in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring. For whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke." So now Mordecai gets to draft a document allowing the Jews to defend themselves against their attackers. In verse 11, it says, "By these letters the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions." And because people rejoice when there is wise leadership in the land, Mordecai's position brings joy. Whereas previously Haman had used his position to bring confusion to the city. So we read in verse 15, "So Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad." And of course, the Jews are happy that they will legally be able to defend themselves. The day comes, and the opposite of what Haman had intended happens. We read in chapter 9, verse 1, "Now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. The Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could withstand them, because fear of them fell upon all people. And all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews, because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. For Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for this man Mordecai became increasingly prominent. Thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. In verse 16, we're then told, the remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives, had rest from their enemies, and killed 75,000 of their enemies, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. So 75,000 people are killed across the empire. Haman's 10 sons are hanged, and his murderous plot is undone. The remainder of chapter 9 then details for us the establishment of the Feast of Purim, which actually sounds a lot like how we often celebrate Christmas, with large meals, great joy, the giving of gifts, and caring for the poor. But there's still one more thing to be undone by the last chapter. In chapter 3, the wicked Haman had been promoted to the top office in the land under the king himself. Mordecai has now taken his place, and he uses the authority of his office for good rather than evil. So in chapter 10, we read, and King Ahasuerus imposed tribute on the land and on the islands of the sea. Now all the acts of his power and might and the accounts of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus, and was great among the Jews and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his countrymen. Now, there are a few things that we could learn from the book of Esther. We could draw some lessons from this book about Christians being involved in politics and seeking the welfare of the people, that power and influence are gifts from God and should be used responsibly and for the benefit of others rather than self-glorification. Haman and others like him used their power to acquire honor and wealth for themselves. Esther and Mordecai acquire power by having good character and then use it for the good of others. So there are some political lessons that we could learn there. There are lessons about surviving in exile when you have no political power, by maintaining your personal integrity, remaining loyal to family, and working for justice. But the real lesson in the book of Esther is the theology of the providence of God in the events of our daily lives, and the theme of reversal by the Lord's providence. God's sovereignty in the story of Esther demonstrates his loving care for his people in their everyday events. And this book, I think, is particularly good for us because we often read the stories of the Old Testament and even in the New Testament, and we're confronted with miraculous events, prophets and apostles who perform wonders and miracles of various sorts, and those things do not often happen in our daily lives. But we read the book of Esther, and there are no, I mean, there are miracles here, but there are no miracles in the sense that we see a prophet calling down fire from heaven or an apostle raising someone from the dead. Rather, it's the miracle of God superintending the little details of everyday life in order to preserve his people. God's name is not used in the story, and yet his fingerprints are all over it. I said at the beginning that the book serves primarily as a meditation on the sovereignty of God over every detail of our lives. And I think it serves as an illustration of Romans chapter 8, verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. The book is filled with these small but very crucial deep details that all work together like clockwork for the benefit of God's people. I mean, if you don't believe in the sovereignty of God over the everyday details of life, then you have to read Esther and believe that Esther just happened to be beautiful, that she just happened to be favored by the man in charge of the young women, just happened to find favor with the king, that she just happened to be Jewish, that Mordecai just happened to have a job that allowed him to be in the right place at the right time to save the king's life, that Haman just happens to mention his troubles with Mordecai to his friends, that his friends just happened to encourage him to build a gallows, that the king just happens to have trouble sleeping that particular night, and that the book that he chooses to have read to him reveals the record of Mordecai's deed, and that Mordecai was never rewarded for that deed. That Haman just happens to come into the court at that exact moment when the king is determined to honor Mordecai. that Haman just happens to be pleading with Esther right at the moment when the king returns from the garden to where they were. I mean, we could go on and on with all of these little details. We see, if you see all of these details in the story of Esther as nothing more than lucky coincidences, then the book of Esther becomes a celebration of Mordecai's wisdom and Esther's courage, which is how it is often presented to us. But that's not how a Christian should read the book of Esther. Esther should be read as a celebration of God's sovereignty in our daily lives. God's sovereignty is a good thing. And Esther should point us to Christ, the sovereign King, who has accomplished the ultimate reversal, the reversal of the cross. In Esther, we see these reversals. Vashti is demoted, Mordecai is promoted. There is a decree against the Jews, there is a decree for the Jews. Haman's plot against Mordecai, and then Haman's defeat. Esther serves as a lesson in reversals and ultimately a preview of the book of Revelation, which reverses what happened in the garden. Adam made a choice in the garden. Jesus later made a choice in a garden. Adam brought sin into humanity by way of a tree. Jesus removed sin by hanging on a tree. Satan rebelled against God, and in the end, Jesus will end that rebellion. The point of Esther is not God's preservation of an ethnic people group, but his redemption of all creation and the display of his sovereignty in all the details of life. So the question we should ask ourselves after reading Esther is, am I recognizing God's sovereignty every day? Am I aware of his goodness to me in all the details of life, in the little things? We don't need miracles and prophets to experience the work of God. We just need to look around us with eyes of faith and be willing to see and to celebrate his deliverance with joy and thanksgiving. Let's pray.